Leslie Hammond is a wildlife filmmaker. Leslie and her partner Jenny have been filming rare and exquisite animals in the remote interior of China and Africa for more than 20 years. They were the first film crew to be allowed into Tibet's Changtang Plateau, which is 16,000 feet above sea level. It was a fascinating but grueling ordeal where everyone lost weight and no one could breathe. In Africa, Leslie learned to face stampeding elephants, and she sailed nervously down the Zambezi River through clusters of angry hippos. And needless to say, part of her mission is to raise awareness about endangered species. And she and Jenny have worked for years, for decades on this. And then one day, they were shooting footage of a panda in an enclosure with her baby. You can hear Mama Panda just chewing on some bamboo, happily, and then all of a sudden, baby panda sneezes. When you see it on the YouTube video, you can see Mama Panda just sort of levitating for a moment. Well, someone took the sneezing panda footage, just 10 seconds of it, and posted it on YouTube, and it went viral. Now, this footage they shot of sneezing baby panda has been seen by 195 million people. The clip's been appearing on TV shows like 30 Rock and South Park and The Ellen DeGeneres Show. At first, Leslie and Jenny were annoyed that the footage had been posted on YouTube. Now they figure, well, if that's what it takes to get the world's attention, then, well, let's go with it. And now they're making a kind of mockumentary about the whole sneezing panda phenomenon. Welcome to you, Leslie. Hello.
Hello, Richard, and thank you very much. Can I just make a point?
Yeah.
It's at 195 million is just on one site.
Just one?
There, it's on hundreds of sites. We're over 300 million hits, I've got to tell you, that we know of.
I beg your pardon. I've been walking around and people go, oh, you're talking to the sneezing panda lady. Are you ready to be known? I mean, you do all this work, and are you ready to be known for the rest of your life as, quote, the sneezing panda lady?
It'll do. It'll do. There are worse things to be known for.
Let's just get this out of the way and talk about what you were doing when you captured the sneezing baby panda. And I'll just play that little noise again because it's adorable.
Well, we were making a program on panda breeding. We have this bizarre distinction of having made more panda programs than anyone in the world. And this, usually we film them in their habitat, but this one was about breeding. So we were in a breeding center in China, and we were waiting and waiting and waiting, as you do with wildlife, for this mother panda to do something, because pandas eat for about 17 to 20 hours a day. That's all they do, because the bamboo has such low nutrition value. And the mother was sitting there, and she put this little six-week-old baby in front of her, and she just kept eating and completely ignored the baby. And so the baby sneezed, this huge sneeze, which I'm sneakingly suspicious that it was also trying to grab a bit of attention from mum, to be honest. She levitated and looked at us. We levitated and looked at her. And we said to the cameraman, holy moly, you have got that camera rolling, haven't you? And he did. So it was luck, because we knew we had a very rare moment.
There is an underlying truth to all this. I suppose if you're filming wildlife, you have to film in easy or painstaking or difficult situations for, what, hours sometimes to get something interesting, some interesting bit of behaviour.
You do. And because our programs, we've done over 30 of them so far, because our programs have been behavioural programs, you're waiting even longer. You do get a little bit of an instinct happens a lot of the time that something's about to happen. And certainly when you've got more than one animal, you do. But pandas are born clowns. So even on their own, and in the film, in Sneezing Baby Panda, the movie, we've got a lot of fabulous panda movement and interaction because we've been doing for such a long, 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 long time. And they will suddenly, they'll look at you and show off. It's the only way you can describe it. And they'll shoot up a tree. They'll twirl around in the branches. They'll fall to the floor in a clown-like fashion. They look at you with a completely po face as they're doing all this activity. And it's astonishing and it's hilarious.
How did you become aware that this little snippet, this 10, 15-second snippet of YouTube video had become a viral sensation?
The guy who fixed our video computers in Melbourne came to fix them one day, knows we're wildlife filmmakers, and said, oh, he said, I've seen this hilarious clip on the net. Look, I'll show you. And he got it up. We looked at it. Heavens above, someone's nicked our footage, the rotten thieving sods. And that's how we found out about it.
So you were really annoyed about it at first?
Well, we were, you know, because it takes many years to get it. It costs a lot of money to go into China and to shoot these things. And these people just take it willy-nilly. I mean, it's the same as me walking down the supermarket shelf and saying, oh, that looks like a great bottle of something or other on that shelf. I'll have that and take it. It's sitting on a shelf. No one owns it, therefore. It's exactly the same thing.
So for the first time in your life, you've made something that became gigantically, massively internationally popular, but you don't get 1 cent from it, do you?
We haven't done. We've got a few little cents from it because we've licensed it a couple of times. Oh. I have to say, 30 Rock used it, and this is an interesting legal point here, Richard. 30 Rock used it illegally. South Park with an animated version, which you can't do, did it illegally. So did Ellen DeGeneres. They used it illegally, and many others we don't even begin to know about. We licensed it to Going the Distance with Drew Barrymore and also to Justin Bieber for his movie because he wanted it.
Justin Bieber's got it.
I know. It is amazing the people in what age group know this clip.
Did you make him sing Happy Birthday over the phone to a niece or something?
I should have done. I've never thought of it. What a good idea. But so what happens legally is that means that we have Tina Fey and Alec Baldwin in our movie because under the fair trade law, because they've used our footage, we can use the bit of footage of them using our footage. So we have a bit of South Park and we have a bit of Tina Fey and Alec Baldwin in the movie, and that's why.
Now, you were filming the pandas at the time at this breeding centre in China. This was around about the time, it was after an earthquake had just hit the place, hadn't it?
We've done it several times. We've been filming at this centre for about 20 years on and off. And that was the area where the massive earthquake was in Sichuan. We actually do have this. It's one serious part in the film, actually. And we went up there because we wanted to use a bit of footage, some children that we'd filmed there. And we didn't want to do that because we knew the odds were, without checking, some of those children probably didn't make it through the earthquake. It was a huge shock, Richard. We went. The Chinese government says everything's now fine. Well, I guess it depends on your definition of fine, really. But going up that road that we've been up dozens of times, where villages were just not anymore, whole mountains had come down, the road had gone, and it was nothing could really, for all the news footage you see, nothing really can prepare you.
Whole mountains had come down.
They'd wiped villages, they'd wiped roadways, they'd filled up part of the river, which was a huge river there. And it was the devastation of that earthquake.
So it's almost, the landscape was unrecognisable.
Oh, some of it was completely unrecognisable. And villages of people that we knew had just gone. Many people we'd known over a long time had just gone. And it was my respect for the Chinese people and how they dealt with that is profound because it's probably the most profound experience I've ever had in my life to actually go into that area and see the massive, massive damage in there.
When you started to film pandas, did you know much about them before you went in to start to film them?
A little bit. There wasn't terribly much known about them at the time. And
talking about the very early 90s here, are we?
We're talking about, yes, the very early, very, very early 90s. We first started going to China, which I went actually as part of a performing arts delegation from the government, and there was about 6 months after the Tiananmen incident. So China, in the years we've been going in the decades, has changed massively in that time.
Oh, right. It was just starting to crack open again after the crackdown of the Tiananmen Square.
And they were still, I mean, we were doing a program on the Golden Monkey at one stage, and we went into a valley. We were actually travelling down a road to go to another area to film, and we couldn't get there because they said there'd been some landscaping on the road. And we said, landscaping? We can get past that. I mean, you're in Australia. Good heavens, we don't worry about a bit of landscaping. Heavens above. We got there, and they actually meant landslide. And there were a half a mountain had come down across the road. Well, the very energetic Chinese with the roadblock had already set up drink stalls and was selling rice crackers and goodness knows what else. But what astonished us was that these guys were there because there were massive boulders had come down. And so they had a crew getting ready to blast them. So one bloke went ahead and dug a little hole. Another bloke came behind him with some gunpowder that he scooped with his hand out of a bag and plopped it in the hole. And the other guy came behind him with a roll of wick. And he would stick a bit of wick in here with the gunpowder. But the thing that
it's like a Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoon.
Oh, it was completely. But what made it even worse, that he had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth with ash dropping down all the time. We were out of there. However, that did mean we had to go to a different unscheduled part of the area to film. And we went into an area that was at that time not open to foreigners. And it was a fascinating area because at that stage, we were the first white people they'd seen in an area called White Horse Valley. And the schoolroom still had the great pictures of Trotsky, Mao, Lenin and Marx at the front of the classroom. But in this area, they still had some women with bound feet. and they still had all the accoutrements of going back to the Mao era. And we then went into somewhere that was a Qing dynasty old courthouse where families were living in that one. And they had a coffin just inside the door, because this is in Shanxi province where the terracotta warriors are. And they bury their dead above the ground. And they still had the body of great-great-great-great-grandma decomposing in a coffin just inside the door when you walked in. But
Open coffin in the doorway?
There was just a bit of it open.
Right.
Some of us looked in, and some of us, being me, certainly didn't look in. But Jenny, I have to tell you, is very happy to look at anything gruesome like this, not me.
so you're going to, when you started going to and filming stuff in China, then it was still living in this kind of, I don't know, a mix between what a feudal society on the one hand and this radical Maoist sort of. Yes. It hadn't really escaped either the feudalism or the Maoism.
No.
Then.
No, they hadn't. And there was also the layer there of fear and cover from Tiananmen and what Tiananmen stood for. And in this era, and this area we were filming in Sichuan, was prior to the crackdown, was part of the old Tibet. And so where the main panda breeding centre is at Wolong, out in West Sichuan, is an area that has a high percentage of minorities. As I'm sure you know, China's 55 nationalities, of which 95% are Han, and the other 54 are other nationalities, one of which is the Tibetans. So they have what they call the Chang people, who are a Tibetan subgroup. And this is the area where a lot of the monks are self immolating and so on, up there. Yes. The problems are. So it was a sensitive area, actually, for them to allow us to go into, but interesting and so, so different.
Now, pandas themselves, I've got a shameful admission to make here. I thought, Leslie, that they were, this is really, I'm realising how stupid this sounds as it comes out of my mouth, but I thought they were kind of like koalas, which of course aren't bears at all, but anyway, I have this picture in my head of them sort of amiably chewing on a stick of bamboo. They're the kind of vegan hippies of the bear community. Just how wrong is that?
Oh, completely wrong, Richard. There's no compromise here at all, you know. They do look like that, and I agree. I mean, they have to eat for 17 to 20 hours a day because of the low nutrition value in the bamboo. But back into the last ice age, they were carnivores, which is why they've got very long claws, and they've got the teeth. If you look at the teeth, they've got the teeth of a carnivore.
Are they still carnivores now?
Yes. If they wander in, a wild panda wanders into a farmer's farm and goes for a sheep because it's in a pen and it can catch it, because basically they're lazy is really the situation. And so if they nab that sheep and they start to eat it, the farmer's not allowed by law in China to shush the panda away. The government recompenses them for the cost of the sheep. So if they can get a quick, easy bite of meat, they're on for it.
So here's my better metaphor. Yes. They're the kind of slacker couch potatoes of the bear world. Then rather than get up the couch, they'll sit there and eat, you know, potato chips.
They will.
But if they have to get up, they'll go and find meat.
They
essentially
will. Absolutely right.
When I say meat, does that mean they, like other bears, would be interested in some circumstances in human meat, in actually attacking and killing and eating humans?
Oh, yes, they do. They, I mean, I don't know that they do that too often, but you wouldn't want to tangle with them. I mean, you're walking into the situation with a dangerous animal the same as you are with a grizzly bear or any other animal there. They eat, their diet was largely bamboo rat. But the bamboo rat is a lot nippier than the panda, so they've sort of been spared death, the jaws of a panda. But we were filming the first time we went, and we were the first Western crew to go in there. They were much more lax than they are now, and I have to say we've got to know those panda keepers very well, working with them for 20 years. They've given us huge, unprecedented access for a long time, which is fantastic. But we were in filming, and when they have them in an enclosure, I'm talking anything from an acre to 100 acres and beyond that they have them in, because they keep them in natural conditions. Or they took us into an area and they let a grown panda out, and we were set up with a tripod and merrily waiting for this bear to come towards
us. Ramble,
you know,
friendly bear.
Yeah, you know, we've all had the panda in the toy chest when we were kids and given it a good cuddle. And this bear came out, took one look at us, and came hell for leather charging at us.
Oh, a panda can charge?
Oh, God, yes. And they can move like the clappers, I tell you that. Yes, yes. Yes, yes, you've got to be very careful of these things, Richard. Well, the cameraman stuck his hand under the tripod with the camera, pulled it back, and everybody leapt back behind a bush, and the panda, you could feel the swish of air as he went past us.
Why was he charging? Was it because you were intruding on its territory,
or, yes.
or it wasn't because he saw you as lunch? No.
Both, probably. Both, probably. He was being an opportunist, but I think his initial thing was he was not used to seeing people, and our smell would be totally different from anything that they'd had there also.
Have you seen what kind of damage they can do to a human being? Yes.
There's a panda keeper. The panda keepers that work with them in the breeding centres get to know them very well because they work with particular pandas. And we've seen a couple of efforts. I mean, there's one that where we were where the guy lost the family jewels. This panda swiped out with his paw. And yes, I know it's leg crossing territory.
That's what I'm doing right now.
I'm not a panda, you say. And lost a lot, and they had to jam tiles on the front of him, rush him to the nearest hospital.
We've seen
another one where the panda was probably just playing, but, you know, they're bears with big claws, and it bit half his thigh away.
Wow. Like, yes. It'd be an embarrassing thing to say, well, the reason why I can't have kids is because I was swiped by a panda.
Yeah, it would be. It would be.
So then you, I suppose, have to learn a proper respect for what is a wild animal. I mean, we can't help but, it seems humans can't help but anthropomorphize pandas because they're cute, they've got the eyes, they've got the cuddly factor, yes. But they're not, they're animals. They need to live and survive.
They are. That's true of any wild animals. Mm. I mean, a lot of the time when you see news stories of people that have been attacked by an animal or whatever, usually they've been stupid, the human, not the animal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if you have to respect them. You're absolutely right. They're territorial. You're a stranger on their landscape and you are food. I mean, I can remember we were making a program on lions in Africa years ago and you were told we were staying in one of those places, you know, Richie sort of camps. We'd done a deal with them actually. But so that if you're going to go out after dark, they tell you to call for a guard, an armed guard, to come and get you and bring you into the bomber for dinner. Well, there was this woman who decided at twilight, you know, dawn and dusk, the two primary eating times for wild animals, decided she just quickly whipped back to her little room, put on some gold sandals before she went into the bomber for dinner. Now, under her hut was a lioness and a couple of cubs. She was dinner.
She was dinner.
She was dinner.
That was the end of her?
That was the end of her.
Yeah. You misunderstand these creatures at your own peril.
You do.
Chinese people have been trying to, they've been trying to breed pandas in captivity for what, decades now, haven't
they?
And reintroduce them into the wild. How successfully can a domestically reared panda be reintroduced to the wild?
Richard, I don't think it's any different from most species. And the pandas so far, yes, they have been. What the panda is saved as a museum species, if you like. They can breed pandas in captivity. That's no problem. But to put them into the wild, a captive-born panda, is a whole other thing. We filmed the first release into the wild years ago of a panda bred in captivity. That panda survived for a couple of months, and then it was attacked by other pandas. It might have been, because they're very solitary creatures, and it might have been that it was trying to sidle up to a female to mate, because the females are only on heat about 2 days of a year. And another male panda may have been caught in something like that. Now they're doing a whole other way of trying to achieve it now. And it's still unknown. There's been one out for some months now in the wild, but what they're now doing is they're using sperm from a wild panda that they collect, and they use that with a mother panda. They pick a suitable one so that they're trying to get as much of the instincts of a panda, of a wild panda, into the newly born panda. Then they do this thing you may have seen news stories where the panda keepers, because they don't want them to be imprinted by humans, they dress as pandas or they dress as a tree and they go out. It's hilarious. And they go out with the pandas and they take them food or whatever. They're the worst looking panda suits you've ever seen in your life. And I am absolutely convinced that the pandas look at them and think, my God, look at these human dingbats here. We'll go along with it. They're going to give us a feed.
Whatever. If that's what you need to do.
Bring it on. Exactly.
You wear that suit. Yes. Good on you.
So they've released a panda now into the wild that's been bred in this way. So far as they're aware, it survived. I mean, they can put a tracking device on them, but they give out after a period of time. And so far, so good.
Why is it so hard for pandas to breed in the wild? Why is there this need to actually breed them in captivity?
Well, if we don't breed them in captivity, they will die out as a species. Like a lot of species, their habitat has been and continues to be destroyed. And we push them further and further out. And in doing so, they can no longer survive. And so if we don't breed them, they will go.
So is it because of the destruction of this habitat that they may need to be eating bamboo all the time? Maybe all their energy, I'm not an expert, but it must then go towards staying alive and drawing nutrition from bamboo.
Yes, it is. And the nutrition of the bamboo is so low that they have to eat for that length of time. in there. But because the female panda is, as I mentioned a moment ago, only on heat 2 days a year, and then given they're solitary creatures, then in that 2 days she has to happen to be around an amorous male, and then the amorous male has to decide that that's what he'd like, a little bit of hanky-panky. You know, the odds are not great. I mean, in the panda breeding centres, they now, because the males are so solitary, and because, I don't know if they're a bit thick or they've got a low libido or whatever it is, Richard, but what they do now is they show porn movies to pandas in captivity. They show,
what?
Yes, they show pandas in the preamble and in the mating act, and the pandas sit there. It's hilarious to watch. So you've got on one side, you've got the keepers watching the monitors with the pandas watching the monitors on which they're playing a bit of panda porn. And it's one of the funniest things I've seen. And the pandas sit there with their po faces munching away at the bamboo looking at porn movies.
They're fed by people in panda suits. I mean, you know, that all our sexual needs should be so eagerly met by a team of helpful professionals like that.
Mind you, you really wouldn't want to have them peering at you through a monitor.
No, that's certainly true, and you want to eat more than bamboo in your diet, I suppose.
You certainly would.
Going into these remote parts of central China, how were you greeted by locals? Because, of course, you'd be the first, you know, Europeans that they would ever have seen.
That's true, certainly some years ago, less so now. When we, for the much of the earlier part, this was the era when much of China was closed to any foreigners. And so special permission had to be gained by the people we worked with there for us to go out into these areas. And it was fantastic, Richard. I mean, one of the things I've learned as a middle-class Australian girl, that I've learnt in all of these societies, in, if you like, third world, I hate all those terms, but never mind, you know what I mean, in there, is that you go to these places, they are poorer than poor, but they share with you whatever it is that they have, food, shelter, whatever. And in that process, and they are not judgmental, we are so judgmental as a society. We're so selfish. I mean, I, as a fifth generation Australian, I'm so embarrassed by our refugee policies now. I've experienced such kindness from these people, from many of these people in these countries. And here we are, a supposed caring Christian society, and we've got millions of people, not even just the ones here on boat, coming on boats, but people, millions of them, in refugee camps in Iran, in Syria, and they will never get out. They've been there for decades. And we just say, no, don't come here. Well, how to breed a terrorist program. However, I have digressed. In there, for me, they've been the most wonderful experiences, because it takes you past so much artifice that we have in modern society, and those people have welcomed us hugely.
There is a flip side to encountering superstition too. Like, I met a guy once who was travelling through in parts of China years ago on a train through a district where there had been earthquakes, and he had sort of reasonably darkish skin but very pale blue eyes.
Yes.
And word got through the train that the devil was on the train, and nothing bad happened to him, but it was a rather awkward thing at the time. Did your presence frighten some people?
If they were frightened, I don't know about it. I mean, I know we had one guy came with us, a camera assistant, and he was a large chap, and he had red hair and red hairy arms. And we were in Yunnan province in the south of China. And I can remember people always intrigued by Charlie's red hair and his red hairy arms. And he was also very strong. And so if we out, because we always carry a minibus because we can keep our gear on it with us for security reasons, and Charlie could pick up one end of a minibus and move it if we had to get out of a tight spot. But in the so looking at that, the young girls in particular, the Chinese, would cluster around Charlie, and I'd say, it's okay, you can touch his arm, that's okay, because you knew they were fascinated. But I don't think they were frightened. They were very friendly, shy, but not, I don't think, frightened.
Can we talk about yaks now?
Yes.
I want to talk about yaks, because I've never talked about yaks on this program before. Why did you want to go and film Tibetan yaks to begin with?
Well, why do you want to film any species? I mean, I suppose I wanted to go to Tibet, and Jenny wanted to go to Tibet. And we then had to find an animal that lived in Tibet that was a wild species. So we found about the wild yak as opposed to the domesticated yak. And it was interesting, because at the time we chose to do this, the Panchen Lama, not the current one, the one before that, had said that the quality of the domestic yak had diminished, and that therefore they had to have a wild yak breeding program. Well, this was right up our alley. We were off. And wild yaks are massive, much bigger than the normal yak you see in other countries. And if they lick you, they've got like little Velcro hooks on their tongues. They will rip your flesh off the arm just with a lick.
Just with a lick of the tongue?
Mm.
A wild yak will do that?
Yes, it will.
And will it want to lick you?
Well, I didn't ask, and I didn't hang around.
I mean, because, you know, animals do that to get the salt off your skin sometimes,
don't they?
Yes,
well, probably they do. I mean, I know Jenny's been licked by a sun bear, also equally extremely dangerous, where he came up and stood on his hind legs and sniffed all over and had his long claws, and they're the fiercest of the bear species. And he licked her arm. Now, in that case, he probably did see her as a great mobile salt lick in that instance. Happily for her, she didn't taste salty enough, and he turned around and walked away.
Great. Better that he saw her as a salt lick than a meat tray, wasn't it?
Exactly right. We were a walking restaurant. But Tibet was amazing. Well, the Changtang Plateau is the largest wild plateau, nature reserve in the world, and it's very high. We were up at the height of Everest Base Camp. We're way beyond the tree line, and where the Tibetans put us down with putting our tents and our camps was summer that we went. I mean, you wouldn't go in winter. It was actually littered with the carcasses and the bones of yaks that had perished in the weather up there. And you had to be a bit careful, because if a bear or a wild yak came wandering your way, I mean, you know, I'm happy for them to do so, but I want them to be at the distance of a camera lens. Thank you very much.
On ABC Local Radio, this is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
My guest today in conversation is Leslie Hammond. Leslie and her partner Jenny have been making wildlife films all over the world, particularly in the most remote parts of China and in Africa, for more than 20 years. They've been filming all kinds of fascinating animals that are endangered, and they've shot to fame by a tiny little snippet of film they shot of a baby panda sneezing. That's the way it works in the wildlife filming stakes. We were talking then about you filming yaks on the Changtang Plateau in Tibet. Describe this landscape for me. You said it was as high as Everest Base Camp. What's the land like up there?
Absolutely barren. It was just plain dirt, tiny little bits of grass. You would get no bushes, certainly no trees. We were way beyond the tree line. And you could see, the funny part was, we were driving there, you thought, gosh, look at those funny little snow-covered hills over there, till you registered they were actually the tips of bloody great mountains. They weren't little hills at all, to get a perspective, but it's absolutely barren. And you can see for quite a long distance. Of course, with such a low oxygen level, we had little, you know, bathroom tents set up in the distance. And if you wanted to go and have a pee, you're talking 10, 12 feet away, you really thought about it. How much do I want to go? Because the lack of oxygen, the energy required, because it absolutely saps your energy to move that 10 feet, is huge.
What you have to, 10 feet?
You're thinking about it. You're really thinking about, because the trouble with breathing is huge. I mean, some of us had altitude sickness. We did all the days and went up slowly that you do to adjust. Jenny had terrible problems with altitude sickness. I didn't. It was lucky. Our crew member, you know, the redoubtable Charlie with the red hair, Charlie lost a stone up there in that time just from the effects of the altitude. I mean, we were at an area where yak caravans were still coming through. We bumped into a yak caravan. This is an area where they bury all their dead, animals and humans, by chopping them up into little pieces, because they can't cut into the harshness of the rock and the land surface, and they wait.
Well, the ground's too stony and cold.
Yeah, too stony, too cold, too icy. And so they have it on a rock somewhere, and they wait for a big eagle or something to come in and take the body away in bits and pieces. And what they're saying is that it's being taken by the winds. And that's why you see often there they have the Tibetan flags that are fluttering. It's all related to this very, very, very poetic notion of how you deal with it.
Aerial burial. That's what it's known as, isn't it?
Aerial burial,
where scavenger birds come up and take it away into the sky.
And it's rather nice. It's a lovely idea. I think it's much better than popping people in the ground, but that's a personal view.
What did the local nomadic people make of you there? Did they say, you've come all this way to film our yaks?
Yes, they do, pretty much. But, I mean, these are people that have their whole existence is from the yak. They live in a tent that's made of yak hair. They dry the yak dung and use that to burn as fires. They eat the meat and they drink the milk, which is yak butter tea, I have to tell you, is disgusting.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Repulsive. If you're ever offered it, tell them you're off it this week or something, Richard. Don't have it.
give it a miss. I'll just stick to the hot water, thanks.
You'll know, because the smell is something else again, too. But the other thing, we were sleeping in tents, and we were unusual to the locals. We'd wake up in the morning, and we were in big army tents by the stage in our sleeping bags. And at the foot of the bed would be several dozen Tibetans that had come, and they were just standing at the foot of the bed, staring at us, smiling. They were very friendly, and some of them were sort of knitting and had a plastic bag on their arm with the wool in, and knit, knit, knit. And others had their faces peering through the doors to have a look at us, and they'd come in their best clothes. Little girls would be there in sand shoes, tracksuit bottoms, and then a pretty pink party frock with sparkles on it over the top of that. They'd come to make a big impression on us, and they did. But they were sweet. They were incredibly sweet and incredibly generous, and we were these Martians that were there.
So they're, of course, perfectly adjusted to the high altitude, and they can breathe just fine.
Yes.
And so you're kind of like fish floundering out of water there.
Yes.
And you must have seemed very weird to them. So did they followed you everywhere, did they?
They did. They did. Once we got into the vehicles to go out with our cameras and everything to film and look for a yak. I mean, talk about, you know, looking for a needle in a haystack, but we did find some. And that's how we found the yak caravan and so on in there. But then when we come back at the end of the day, they'd be back there again to have another look at us and what were we eating and look at those funny-looking beds and all the rest of that.
How long did you stick it out there on the Chang Tang Plateau without any air to breathe?
Up on the actual plateau, probably about just under a month.
A month.
Mm.
And you just got too sick after a while.
Well, we did. And Jenny and I decided on one particular day. We came down a bit earlier than we'd expected to. And we thought we were actually killing the crew. Everybody was not well. And so we came down. But I have to say, it was wonderful coming down because your red blood cells suddenly multiply and you feel $1 million as you're coming down. And then we'd stopped a little truck stops on the way. We have these little, in Beijing they call them juts, or little dumplings. And you'd sort of sit in this tin covering where they were making the fresh dumplings, the best food I've ever tasted, I have to tell you. And they'd have a roll of pink loo paper in the middle of the table, which is there for you, you know, as the napkin equivalent. And you're in there, fingers the lot, and eating these wonderful, wonderful Tibetan dumplings.
Leslie, you've been into Africa many times as well and travelled down the Zambezi River. So you're doing this whole heart of darkness thing going
absolutely.
right into the middle of it. You went into the Congo. Why did it take you? Why was it so difficult getting into the Congo when you went in?
We were really in Zambia, on the Zambian side of the Congo, and we were actually going up to a chimp sanctuary, and we wanted to film there. There's a wonderful place called Chimfunchi, which is now much more developed than it was then. And north of Lusaka, the capital of Zambia. They tell you there are bandits on the road all the way up. So we got a minibus that didn't look too flash from the outside because we always try and look a bit shabby because otherwise you just stand out too much as foreigners. And also we've got expensive gear on board. So we're in there and we made sure we had one that had a black Zambian driver, again, for obvious reasons. And so one of the things you learn as a wildlife filmmaker, because, again, animals are pushed so far out, you're very often in areas where you see AK-47s and Kalashnikovs and the like. And so on this road, there would be bandits with Kalashnikovs and AK-47s to hold you up. But the police were every 100 kilometres. You would stop at a roadblock where they'd be there armed to the teeth as well. But as we got up, and when we got up very near the border with the Congo, we got into this town and the driver didn't know how to get where we were going. So he pulled in off the main road. And to our complete horror, there are a couple of hundred black guys having a rumble, two separate groups, absolutely shaping up for a fight.
What, a gang fight?
A gang fight. And they had lumps of lead pipe, they had wood, they had whatever things to hit. We pulled right into the middle of them. And so the head guy, who looked, you know, absolutely blood-curdling, the bandana and his lump of lead pipe and all the rest of that, and he was talking to our driver, who was talking through the window, and we were there for ages, and I thought, and they were all circling our bus and looking in the windows and looking pretty threatening, I've got to say. So I thought, I don't know, I think, you know, a friendly smile can take you a long way in life. So I slid back
sometimes.
The window. So I slid back the window and smiled sweetly as I could muster it up and warmly and said hello to this gang leader. And he looked at me and then they all stood there peering at me, this mass around me. And then he talked to the driver a bit later and then he came back to the window and he said, "Hey, mama, don't you worry. I take you to your monkeys." And he put a guy in the bus with us who looked us absolutely absolutely fearsome as he did. And they smiled and waved us goodbye before they went back on belting the hell out of each other. And he took us to our monkeys. But the road up there, because at that stage there were a lot of people coming out and trying to escape, refugees from the Congo. And it wasn't terribly far. And it was about 20 kilometres. And we were going along this immensely potholed road with tens of thousands of humanity surging in the opposite direction. And the clapped-out buses that you see with baggage hanging off them and people, we were straight into that. And it took us 4 hours to do 20 kilometres because of this great surge of escaping humanity going in the opposite direction.
When you were filming elephants, what did you learn about driving into a herd of elephants, what you should do if you drive, if you, you know, stumble, if that's the word for it, into a herd of elephants?
Well, there's one little tiny step before you leave that you need to remember, Richard, when you go to Africa. And I'm sure you don't wear Chanel number 5. I think it is Chanel that is the issue.
Not lately.
Not lately. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. Probably when you're a Doug Antony all-star, I know. You pop people all a bit dodgy
the
there.
Just stank like hell then.
Oh, God, yeah. That sounds nice. Male elephants on heat are apparently turned on by probably Chanel number 5. So the first thing you have to say to people on the crew is no perfume, certainly not Chanel, and no bright clothes, because that male elephant will pursue your vehicle to mate with your vehicle and you if you've got that smell that's absolutely turned him on. So that's step number one. Then if you're out there driving and you come across a herder, it conjures up a lovely image, doesn't it?
I know. What are they planning to do once they get hold of the...
Richard, the mind boggles, I wouldn't go there.
I know. Where would the...
Yes.
I can't... Anyway, they'd find some solution, I'm
quite
sure.
Quite a coupling, yes. Yes. But so then if you do come across some elephants, firstly, you have to be very careful not to split a herd. And so you wait if there's a herd. Then the first thing you do when you see an elephant, and certainly when you see a herd, is you turn off the engine and stop and turn off the engine and wait. Now, the elephants will become quite curious sometimes, particularly the young ones, and they're likely to come around the vehicle. And one of the things you have to learn with any wild animals is that you don't break the line of the vehicle. You don't stand up or put a hand out the door or anything like that, because they think you're another big animal. And you're in an open vehicle. It doesn't matter, because if a lion wants to get you, he'll bite through a steel door anyway. So, you know, you're in an open vehicle because you're filming. And my fear is always, if that trunk happens to hit the odd exhaust pipe, then you're a pancake in 2 seconds flat.
They'll just stomp it, right? It's a threat.
They've burnt it. But what they do, we were filming hippos in Zambia at one stage. We had this guy who was a tourist guy who was up at the camp. And he had all his bangles up his wrists and his beads, and he looked like an African tour guide straight out of the movies. And it's wonderful staying there, because you have your dinner on the banks of the Zambezi with a candelabra on the table, and it's very romantic and very everything you've ever seen from the Africa Queen onwards. And over dinner one night, and we were having a few bottles of very nice South African red, and this guy was going on. He said, I grew up in Zimbabwe. And he said, we had a man who was like an elephant whisperer, a black guy. And he said, what you do if an elephant ever charges you, you put up your hand and you click your fingers and the elephant will stop instantly.
What?
And go away.
There's a charging elephant and
you click your fingers.
You stand up, you put your hand in the air and you do that.
That's nonsense. Richard, we had the same reaction. And we said, oh, go on, give it a break. You know, we're good, sensible Australians here. We don't buy all these wanky old stories, you know. Anyway, so the next day he said, would you like me to drive you out? You're going to shoot today. And I know a shortcut to the hippos. And we said, yeah, oh, yeah, that'd be great. Thanks. We rounded a corner and we came across a herd of elephants. And it was a breeding herd, which are the hub with the big matriarchs. They're the fiercest. And which they had some males, fully grown males with them. Well, a fully grown male cut the engine, stopped, did all of that, turned around, looked at it. An elephant is a species that will probably, most of the time, do a mock charge first. So with that, the elephant's scraping his feet and he's flapping those great African elephant ears, trumpeting, and then off he comes. He starts the charge to the vehicle. Up this guy's hand goes, clicks, and the elephant goes, stops, dust's going everywhere. He looks at us. And I'm weak at the knees by this stage and so on. And so with that, he looks and we think, now, is he going to turn and walk away? That's the mock charge. No, he didn't. He then started the real charge. And there's no second mock. It's the real one at this point. So at this point, this guy's hands has gone into the air. He clicks again, and the elephant goes and stops, literally at the end of the bonnet of the car. Now, I'm thinking, well, this is it on my tombstone. She tried hard, but she was squashed by an elephant in Africa or something lyrical like that. He stopped. He flung dust everywhere again, trumpeted, looked at us, and turned and walked off. And I said, I'm so sorry for calling you wanker last night.
That really worked. You saw that actually happen. You saw this with your own eyes.
Yes.
A guy stopped a charging elephant twice by raising his hand and going...
Clicking. Now, I couldn't do it, Richard. My palms were far too sweaty to be able, in that moment, to be able to muster a clicking hand. So I can tell you that. I'm gone.
But you're just doing this.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't have believed it, but yes, I saw it.
So I suppose you need the presence of mind and non-sweaty palms to make it work. Now, I want you to tell me why it's a bad idea to go bungee jumping off a bridge into the Zambezi River. Why is that a bad idea?
Well, it's an extremely bad idea. And the South African tourism figures, all the sub-Saharan African tourism figures don't tell you this. What happens when you've got hippos in the river, and of course they're submerged, and then as people jump, they go down, the hippo comes up, rises up from the river below with his mouth and those great white chompy teeth, very wide open. Now, if you're a little bit heavier than the rope's supposed to be, or I always think it looks like somebody on rubber bands, that it is quite known for people to lose a limb or indeed to be bitten in halves. Because if they go down and the hippo comes up that bit, there's a critical mass that disappears in the middle and you get bitten.
Well, you lose an arm or
a leg or your torso. You get bitten in halves, yes. I mean, you're a human yo-yo, Richard.
I just try to imagine you say, you know, you sure this is safe? And the guy says, yes, it's completely safe. And then you jump off, and as you go down, this hippo, you're seeing this hippo come towards you with its gaping maw.
Yes.
And even if you escape the first time, you've got to come back down again.
You do. I mean, you wouldn't get me bungee jumping for quids, but I mean,
no.
That story absolutely puts me right off, because what if it does stretch? What if it becomes undone? You know, and I mean, they do say to you, you know, look, this is perfectly safe and we've been tested by the government, department of so-and-so and all the rest of that, but hey, no.
Travelling down the Zambezi River in a boat, you saw one day some villagers eating hippopotamus. Is that rare?
It is rare. It became less rare than it used to be because in the Mugabe regime in Zimbabwe, a lot of the wildlife areas there and a lot of that wildlife has been killed because people simply had to exist. And so anywhere they could get food, they had to take it. And so they've attacked the wildlife. We were heading down the Zambezi and we looked over to one side and there were about 20 people hacking into a hippo with huge bladed knives. Now, we've never seen it before. And one's first reaction is how terrible. But then you realise these people are starving. It's about existence for them.
As you travel down that river, you're going to encounter hippopotami, is that the Greek plural, and maybe crocodiles as well. What's your experience of that? And how do you deal with it?
Well, how do you deal with it? We were filming the hippo program. I mean, they are submerged and you've got a whole pod. And we were going down somewhere called the Chifungulu Channel, which at that stage and probably still is uncharted. And the people that we'd worked with to get us there had got this new little tinny boat. And before that, they'd had these banana boats, which were much narrower than this little tinny. So we're going down the Chifungulu Channel. We could feel bump, bump, bump. And we thought, gee, the water must be shallow here. And so he said to the guy, you know, can we not sort of go out to the middle of it? It's not so shallow. He said, oh, it's not that the river is shallow. We are bumping on the backs of the hippos.
My God.
And so he said, but we'd already been warned before, and we could see the crocs over on the bank, that if you're in that situation and your boat is upset and you fall into the river, if there are hippos there, you have to get away and get to the bank as quickly as you can because the hippo thinks you and the boat have attacked it, so it will attack back. But if you're swimming over there and there are crocs present, you've got to get back onto the boat very quickly, otherwise you'll go. I mean, it's a whole new version of A Rock and a Hard Place.
Double jeopardy.
Jeopardy, it is. But this did happen to us. A hippo came off the bank and wanted to join his pod, went down and went under our boat, but it was a bit wider than they knew. It wasn't a narrow banana boat. And he came up too quickly on the other side and boom, Jenny went flying over to the left side of the boat. The cameraman and the camera went flying. I went flying. We fortunately didn't finish up in the drink. And the hippo turned around and gave us the filthiest look. and he rejoined his pod.
Because they
are so, a close call.
They are so fiercely territorial.
They're the fiercest animal in Africa by a long way.
So that's how, can you sort of see the, I don't know if that's a silly way of anthropomorphising again, but can you see their rage? Can you feel their rage at intruding upon their
area? Oh, you can. But, you know, when the hippo opens its mouth, that's a threatening sign. He's not actually yawning or about to burst into song or anything like that. That is a threat. If you're, he comes up out of the water, opens his mouth, and that is the sign, you get the hell out of here.
And the teeth that are inside that, don't they have these gigantic grinding molars?
They're huge teeth. And they've been being killed in the wake of the elephants. And sadly, unfortunately, poaching of elephants is resuming again now, I'm hearing. But when the ivory was taken off the market from elephants and the trinkets there, they then began going for the hippos to get their teeth to replace that market.
You mentioned there you had an encounter with a sun bear, which came up to your partner Jenny and friendly, a little cuddle. Just how dangerous is it to be in proximity to a sun bear? And this is in China, isn't it?
No, this was in Thailand, northern Thailand. It's very dangerous. They are the fiercest of the bear species, and bears are pretty fierce, and they've got very, very long talons. And when he got up and stood on his hind legs, he was probably about 5'7" tall, top of his head. And so he came up and got onto his hind legs, because we were actually busily engrossed watching the cameraman down on the ground. He was with the camera getting a shot of another sun bear somewhere, and this little number snuck up on us. And he stood on his hind legs, and we knew, as with any wild animal, the worst thing you can do is to turn and run or to move or to make a noise or anything. You just stay as immobile as you possibly can. And he got up onto his hind legs. He put his nose right up by her face and started sniffing her face and her head. And we were able to stay frozen to the ground. And then he went down her arm and started to lick her arm. And we just stood there, didn't make a sound. And he, as I said earlier, she obviously wasn't salty enough. It wasn't to his taste. And he turned around and shuffled off.
Now, in that moment, and this might be a silly question, but you're, of course, consumed by terror and, yes, and this feeling like, oh, my God, I'm about to be mauled or eaten, yes, by this fierce bear. Is it a mixed feeling? Mixed in with that is this feeling like, God, you're so beautiful.
Yes, absolutely. It is a mixture of exhilaration and utter sheer terror.
That's the charisma of these animals.
It is. I mean, animals are funny. I'm convinced they've got a sense of humour. I'm absolutely convinced they have. And in the wild, the thing that strikes me about them is they're so balletic. We're doing a film at the moment, which is for cinema release eventually, that is as fantasy with animation. This has live action animals in it. And really the idea came from that, from sitting watching animals, and at this stage we're in Africa, watching them in the wild, just how balletic, how graceful they are. But they also, there's an empathy within them, within each other, and our programs have always been behavioural programs, so we're always looking for the encounters between animals and between species. And they have all the emotions, or they would appear to, that humans do, including humour. I mean, we were filming humpback whales off Tonga, and we were in a 28-foot aluminium craft, and there was a massive great humpback, a mother, her baby, and the male escort she's got with her. And this male escort came up to the side of the boat, rolled a bit on his side, and this great eye was looking at us all, picking us all out.
You're looking directly into the eye of a whale.
Looking directly, looking into it. And we're going, wow, because he's right up by the boat. With that, he lifts this thumping great pectoral fin, which is about 12 feet long, up into the air.
12 foot long.
And he's about to slam it down. You can see it's coming down because you've watched the behaviour. And you think, this is it. We're flotsam and jetsam. We're within that 12 feet. We're gone. And with that, he just sort of goes, ha ha, and slides it down to one side. And so it crashes in the thing. And you're standing there because he's done a blow. And you're covered in whale snot and salt water. And it is so exhilarating.
He did you a favour, made you glad to be alive.
Oh, you know you're alive, Richard, yeah. I can tell you that.
You live completely in the moment, in that absolute instance. You mentioned there that animals in the wild, how graceful they are. It struck me, the thought just then, that maybe all animals are graceful and economical, including humans, it's, I suppose, but being human, we're self-conscious.
Yes.
And it's our self-consciousness that makes us awkward.
I think that's right.
So to be human is to be awkward.
Perhaps. Yes, I think so.
And to be non-human is to be graceful, I suppose.
That's true. I mean, people naturally, I think, do have rhythm and do have movement. And dance is a basic instinct, if you like, of human beings. And some of us are a little more graceful than others. Mm. And some of us learn to be more graceful and become dancers.
A natural instinct, it would seem.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. But you don't get that same, I mean, unless the species has it particularly to the human eye, clumsy gait. But even then, you've still got a rhythm there. There's still a rhythm.
You mentioned they're just staring into that eye of that whale in the water right next to you. Have you had those moments of strange intimacy where you can see yourself being seen by the animal?
You do. It's actually a very interesting moment. We've had it with elephants, lions, chimps, all sorts of the monkey species and a lot of different animals. And when you look at them, there is a connection that happens with the eyes into your eyes. And I have to say, you know, you often see a greater shining light of intelligence in those animal eyes than you see in a lot of human eyes. But when you're looking into the eyes of a chimp or a gorilla, for example, I mean, they're less than 2% of difference from us. And it's all there. You know, I mean, the things that they do, when you look at them, I remember looking at a chimp once whose baby had died. And she didn't want to part with the carcass of this baby. It was a tiny, tiny baby, and it was starting to rot away. And the other chimps would move into her from the troop, and they were being very sympathetic and respectful to her, and they were trying to go in to take that baby from her because they knew the baby was dead. She would not part with that baby. I mean, she slung it around like a bloody old handbag, I've got to say. But she was not parting with that. Her grief was so profound, and it was incredibly moving to watch her do that.
It's like when I've witnessed the birth of my own children, it's one of those rare moments you get in life where you go, oh, my God, we're mammals. I know, yes. I know we know it, but we don't really know it until we see something like childbirth take place. Is it when you have those kind of very personal encounters with animals, does it remind you of your common mammal status?
It does. It does a number of things, Richard, actually, for me now, because we see so much destroyed habitat in that, and you see, therefore, what's happening to the species. I mean, I think it's a great wake-up call for we human animals on this planet too. If we don't look after this planet, if they die, as the saying goes, we die. And I just don't believe that enough people actually comprehend that, and certainly not enough politicians comprehend that in their denial of climate change.
It's been so wonderful hearing these great stories from you. It's hilarious, too. And remember, don't go bungee jumping in the Zambezi River. One thing I'll take away from this conversation is that.
Yeah, I know, you're absolutely right, Richard.
No desire to be severed by a waiting hippo in the waters below. I wish you all the best with your Sneezing Baby Panda mockumentary moving on to bigger and better things. It's been so lovely speaking with you.
Thank you very much, Richard. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.